So, recording started. Perfect. Very nice. So, welcome all of you to another edition of Social Computing and Social Gaming. Is that loud enough for those in the back? Presumably so. Okay. Good. So, today we will be dealing with centralities again. So, social network analysis, social networks as long-term social contexts, and we've been dealing in the last lecture with the basic terminology on centrality. So a node or an edge was deemed central when some centrality index was high, and we said that these indices should be interpreted on an ordinal scale only. So it's not that if the centrality index of one node is 5 and the other one has only a centrality index of 2.5, then the first node would be twice as central. This is something that in general we just cannot conclude. It's more like the only thing we can say actually is that one node is more central than the other. In general, I would say. And we had several examples. One example was degree centrality, very simple. Just count the number of nodes that a certain given node or edge is adjacent or incident to. This would be a very simple distance and neighborhood-based approach. And we had several others, such as eccentricity and so on. And one thing that we discussed was stress centrality, and the expression for stress centrality was that, right? So we count the number of shortest paths that a certain node is on, and this is the notation, and then this gives our stress centrality. Okay. And then we said, okay, what if we would just count the relative number of shortest paths that a certain node is on? And that gives rise to the first family of measures that we subsumed under betweenness centrality measures, because they formalize the notion of being in between, right? And if you're if you're in between persons in a very combinatorially, in very many ways, I should say, then you are can consider yourself as a central figure, right? So if we envision paths from one person to another as encoding information flows in the social network, we can say if a certain person is on very many shortest paths, this person is considered to be central. And the only difference to stress centrality is that we now consider relative numbers, right? So we have to divide the number of shortest paths from A to B that V is a member of by the total number of shortest paths from A to B. Obviously, sigma AB can be larger than 1 in those cases where we have a number of shortest paths of then equivalent length, but different just directions. Okay, good. And we said, okay, shortest path between the centrality would then also have to average over all such pairs A and B in the graph. And then you have a measure of centrality which is more relative. Individual quantities here can be interpreted as probabilities, obviously, right? So this delta ABs can be interpreted as the probability that a node V is involved in the communication between A and B in that way, right? And we said, good, what's the advantage? The advantage is that shortest path between the centrality lends itself better to our interpretation, or to be according to our interpretation. And we saw that using this example. So in the upper graph, as well as in the lower graph, the stress centrality of each of the gray nodes is 28, which follows from simple combinatorics. And while the shortest path between the centrality in the upper case is 1/3 of the shortest path between the centrality of the single node in the lower graph, lower graphs case, which is much more according to our intuition. Okay, because we see that in the lower example, this assumed person has more communicative weight to bear, while the communicative weight in the upper case is evenly distributed among the gray notes. Okay, good. Same is also possible for edges, obviously. You just have to replace the notes by the edges, and you can come up with a centrality measure for edges. Okay, good. So other variants might kind of take these definitions a bit more in a more relaxed way, right? So we can, instead of considering the shortest path between A and B, for example, consider the set of K shortest paths, right? Or the set of K shortest note disjoint paths, or the set of paths not longer than 1 plus epsilon times the distance between A and B. And let's consider the last case, for example, right? So, obviously, the distance between A and B is given or defined by the shortest path or the shortest paths that exist between A and B. And if we allow ourselves to change that a little bit by an epsilon, the advantage that we get is that these constructions are a bit more stable with respect to small changes in the graph, okay? Because in a given graph, a small change would, for example, correspond to taking away an edge or adding a node or something, right? And this can drastically influence these quantities and these shortest paths. And if we look at those figures with a more coarse-grained view, and if we're more generous and allow not only actually shortest paths, but also paths that are close to shortest by an epsilon, then these constructions are much more stable. Yeah? So the shortest path between the centrality would be a quantity then that's more stable with respect to small changes in the graph. Now you may say, well, why would you consider such changes? And the answer is obviously in long-term social networks or long-term social contexts such as social relations, the dynamic is comparatively small, right? So your set of friends doesn't change every 2 minutes. However, there is some change, right? So you keep on adding new friends, you keep on losing friends in one way or the other. So there is a change, and well, if you want to monitor these quantities across these changes, you have to maintain some sort of stability, right? The same is true for if you visualize social networks, for example, right? So if we have time, we will look at some methods to visualize social networks using, for example, force-based layouts, right? So you introduce forces between the nodes, press it together, spring it up in the air, and then by force, by magical ways of physics, which is then simulated numerically, of course, you will get a layout that's comparatively close to intuition. However, those layouts are also sometimes not very stable, bless you, with respect to small changes. And this is what you would want, because any measure describing a graph or a social network is, as the name suggests, a descriptive measure, which would give you orientation, and a visualization, in a sense, is also a descriptive measure to take, right? So you want to see where are the cliques, what are dense parts of the graph, what are less dense part of the graph, and so on. And these things should naturally be stable towards those changes, otherwise your brain cannot follow these changes, right? So if you have one visualization and you add a node and you do the visualization again and you end up at a very different equilibrium, then your eye just cannot adapt to that, right? That's why we want these things. Good. Okay. Now, what we've seen so far is were mostly centrality measures with respect to vertices. And in some cases, I said, okay, well, you can have the same formula for edges as well. But we may ask ourselves, is there a formal way to translate vertex-based centrality measures to edge-based centrality measures, or vice versa, right? And one idea that could come to one's mind is that we could apply the given vertex centrality formalism to just a transformed version of the graph, which we call the edge graph, right? And, well, if we have the original graph as V and E, the edge graph is just defined by taking the edges as vertices, and two edges are connected in the edge graph if they are originally incident to the same original node, right? So if this is a structure in the original graph and we have E1 and E2, right, then we have new nodes E1 and E2. And in this case, they'd be connected because they're incident to the same node in the original graph, right? However, as we know, the number of edges can be quadratic in the number of nodes, okay, if the graph is comparatively dense. So the size of this new edge graph may be quadratic compared to the original graph. However, these ideas don't work as well as we would think or want them to be. Why is that the case? Okay. So there are several drawbacks in that. So the first one is, we certainly have an intuition what a weight on an edge would mean, right? So this could correspond to a tie strength or the number of physical interactions or whatever, right? So for the social case, it's pretty clear. But what weighted nodes mean is a bit less instructive, right? And the second drawback, which is even more severe, is that if we just do that and switch from the original graph to the edge graph, G prime, then computing applying the same centrality formalism would not give meaningful results. So in that case, let's take that. Okay, so we have this original graph up here with these nodes, and this is then translated into this edge graph. Okay. Now, again, stress centrality for vertices corresponds to the number of shortest paths that use x. Okay. Good. So the stress centrality of our edge A is 3, right? Because that edge A is on all three shortest paths in the graph, right? But in the edge graph, the stress centrality of our now node A is just 0, right? Because every shortest path just doesn't use that, okay? So we see that intuition can get lost while doing so. So these mechanical translations often do not work very well, right? That's why we can have other constructions, for example, the so-called incidence graph, which we denote as G double prime. And what we do here is that we split each original edge and give it a new existence as a node representing that edge, and now we can apply the vertex-based indices. And that's a much more, a better construction, which adheres better to intuition. Okay, so the take-home message is be aware if you do mechanical translations of that sort, they might not preserve what your intuition was. Now to more, even more interesting families of centrality indices. Okay, now those that we had so far were, I would call them a bit mechanical, right? So you solve your all paths shortest path problem. You can do statistics on the number of shortest paths, come up with things like shortest path between us, which are decent, right? So they're used by a lot of people. But isn't there a more subtle way to come up with something like that. And one way is, as you can read, vitality-based indices. Okay? So the intuition is as follows. So you have a measure on the whole graph measuring some property that we here might call a quality. Right? So it's not necessary that this quality measure, in a sense, always corresponds to the bigger is the better, right? Because a graph in itself, why would you call it a good graph, right? So just call it a measure that takes the whole graph and characterizes its important properties of this graph. Now, if you compute that in two versions, one version would be if you keep the node or edge in question, that would be Q of G. And the other version is computed for the graph where you take this node or edge away. Right? And if it's a characteristic property of the graph that is well chosen, we see what the relative importance of that node or edge was. So one example is, for example, these flow problems or other connectivity measures. Wouldn't call it a connectivity measure, other quality measures. And if it's the case that taking away a node would severely influence that measure, then the vitality, as it's called, of this whole graph is decreased, or the vitality of the graph correspondingly very much depends on that node or edge, right? So what could be such measures? So the first measure is so-called flow, okay? And flow is a characteristic graph theoretical construction, and it goes like that. So we have a directed graph, a directed weighted graph. So the edges are given weights. And we interpret those weights as capacities for flows of whatever kind, water, beer, current, whatever, right? So something flows in that graph. And usually if something flows, you need to have a source where the things that flow come into the valve system or the body or whatever other graph you have in mind. And you have to have a sink where things flow out again. And that's the same for like every valve system in a building or for the human body. Yeah, things come in, things go out. Okay, and the flow of S and T from node source node S to sink node T is just defined as the sum of the flows along all edges, and especially of all the out edges of the source, right? So let's say here we have the source node, and the source node is connected to other nodes, and what flows through the whole system would somehow end in the sink, right? And what flows out of S, you just sum up every flow that goes through an edge leaving S, right? You might as well sum it by saying that you sum up everything coming into T, right? And on each edge, there is this quantity of a flow, right? And what a flow is just what currently flows through that edge, okay? Now, of course, if the edge has a certain capacity of 10, let's say 10 liters per second or something, then obviously the flow cannot be 500 liters. So what we need to have is we need to respect capacity constraints, namely that the flow on each edge must be larger or equal than the capacity, the weight. And what we also need to have is balance conditions, right? So if we have some intermediate node, what flows into that node must also flow out again, right? That's only natural. So for each node, we must have a balance equation so that the sum over the out edges of V of all the flows must be equal to the inflow to that respective node V, right? And it's an optimization problem where you would say, well, obviously, to decide whether I want to have a large flow on this, a medium flow on this, and a small few flow on this, is that the best, or would I be better with small, medium, large? And what are the numbers, right? So that's an optimization problem. And if you want, I can put online a set of slides from, I guess it's from Princeton, that I currently retrieved, which explain very well how this is done. Classical problem in graph theory. However, well, you can look that up if you want. The algorithm is called the Goldberg-Tyon algorithm, and we have a complexity of the number of nodes times the number of edges times this expression with that mild logarithm. Yeah, modifying it, right? So we have something in the order of magnitude of V to the power 3, something like that, roughly. Depends on if the graph is very sparse and E is very much smaller than V squared asymptotically, then you're better off in some cases, but this is roughly what we have, right? So this is about computing a flow for a graph, right? So you take any two nodes and assign them the roles of sink and source, and then you compute the flows, right? You can go one step further by saying, well, my quality measure should be like the average over all possible combinations of S and T, right? So this is something that we might call a quality measure. So how, well, transparent is the graph? How much flow would it allow on average, okay? And now it's clear if you take out an edge or a node, which is kind of central for the graph in a way, then this would, this action of taking it away would severely influence this measure, right? So if we had a graph that looked like this, and we have one node here, and there is the sink, and there is, sorry, there's the source and there's the sink. It's clear if I take away that node, then this would severely limit the graph's ability to let something through. Namely, it would just cut it off, right? So this is called a cut vertex if we have a situation like that. Yes? Could be, yes, if you want. So his suggestion was, can you put a model on where you would say, is the edge capacity the maximum allowed annoyance in terms of the number of favors that are done or the number of information that this social relation is willing to transport or whatever? Could be the case, yeah? Number of workload that is transported somehow through that. This depends on what you want to model, right? Good. So this is what we have, okay? Good. So we can choose other versions of that, okay? So in order to just come up with this, the graph before minus the graph after, we can set this relatively into proportion to the graph before, and then what we would then have is a so-called max flow betweenness, right? So if you just compare from this formula here, which does not take this relative to Q of G, this change, right? The betweenness centrality would just do that as before, right? With all the positive consequences, okay? Okay. Good. So this would be like a flow-based vitality index, and you can readily use that. Use the Goldberg-Tyon to compute the max flows, average over them, take away the node that you want to take away, and you'll have it. Well, another version to construct a vitality index would be, comes from wireless communication, and the quality measure is called the Wiener index, right? So this is a famous electrical engineering pioneer, right, where a lot of physical quantities are named of. And so the motivation, as you can read, is that in a wireless communication network, what we would want is that each node should be connected to each other node by as few intermediary nodes as possible, right? So the quality would then be the distance between any two nodes averaged over the building of such pairs. Okay, good. You could write this Wiener index that we have here with the help of our closeness centrality that we have defined by just doing that, because summing over all possible partners W while letting V constant is just the closeness centrality of V, right? 1 over the closeness centrality, I should say, right? So this is precisely what we can write. So, well, this is one thing. Use the Wiener index would function. However, can't we use closeness itself? Okay, so if we would just use our definition of closeness as a vitality index, would that work? So the intuition is yes, why not? It is a certain global graph quality measure in a certain sense. So the number of shortest paths, right? And if I take away a certain node, I would, as in vitality, somehow model the importance of that node, because taking it away might affect the shortest path landscape in a certain way. Good, right? So if we say the distance represents costs to send a message, right, then this would certainly correspond to our intuition, right? Again, if we have such a situation here, such a cut vertex, we might have difficulties in computing these quantities, so then we would have to deal with that in another way. Again, social networks just don't suffer from these structures a lot, right? So they're very well connected, right? So this we would seldomly encounter. Good. So stress centrality in that way, can we use it as a vitality? Once again, this is the definition. And this is the definition for edges, okay? Now, as I said, the intuition states that stress centrality seems to be, in a sense, the number of shortest paths that we would lose if V wasn't available anymore, right? Because sigma AB, number of shortest paths from A to B using V. Good. Okay, now, as you might have read already, this is not a very good choice, because it is the case that the number of shortest paths might actually increase if we take away a node, right? And this is once again a misleading thing. And if that is the case, obviously we cannot use stress centrality as a vitality index directly. Let's look at an example, right? So this is a given graph, and if you believe me, the number of shortest paths in that graph is 54, okay? So the number of shortest paths that contain the edge E is actually 8, okay? Good. Now, if you take away E, this edge, the number of shortest paths in the graph changes, and it's now 64, right? Okay, admittedly, 18 of them have increased in length, but the sheer number has increased, okay? So before, sigma CD was 1, and now sigma CD is 4. So we've seen, going back one slide, the number of shortest path can increase if we take away a node, right? So what should we do with that situation? So we could use stress, but we would have to regard one thing, right? We would have to do our statistics only using those paths that have not increased in length. Hi. And if we do that, things would work, right? So for stress-like centralities, we would have to compute these things. But in order to just use sigma AB, we would have to add an expression singling out those paths that have not increased in length. And there we would get to know a new notation, which is called the Iverson notation. So before, stress was just end it here as a definition. Now we have this thing here in square brackets. And the Iverson notation is always in the square brackets. It contains a logical expression, for example, this equality here. And it evaluates to 1 if the logical expression is true, and it evaluates to 0 if the logical expression is false. And in that way, you can elegantly single out certain quantities that you don't want. In this case, we don't want to count any paths that have actually changed their length, because then this interpretation would fail in that way that we just discussed. Okay? So if we would just count the lengths, the paths with lengths that are untouched, then taking away V and doing the statistics would actually correspond to V's importance in this path, in this landscape of shortest paths, right? So this is an important notation that we will be frequently will be using, right? Good. So that is the major part on that. Now we will discuss two more things on centrality, right? So the last thing that we will discuss today at the end is feedback centralities, and a typical representative of that class is Google's PageRank. So we'll have that at the end. But before we do that, I would very much like to introduce you a paper by Mark Newman. And that paper I put online, although at least I put a link to that paper online, and I would like you to study that as a case study for centrality indices. Okay, and we will look at the basics of that paper now, and this is a good background reading for those that are interested in those topics. So, well, a major critique with respect to shortest path betweenness is that in a social network, things, whatever things may refer to, do not only flow along shortest paths only, right? So, for example, gossip or news or influence or other things would naturally distribute along paths, obviously, and they would be less willing to distribute themselves along long paths. But that doesn't really imply that only shortest paths are used. Okay? So look at this example here. So we have one group, one graph, another group, another social network, and they're connected by this bridge here. Okay? So the vertices A and B will, if the topology of group 1 and 2 is not too exotic, will have a very high shortest path between this centrality, but the vertex C will not, obviously, because if everything flows along shortest paths, then everything would flow here, or here, or here. But it would certainly be very much less likely to take the detour over C. And that is reflected in the actual numbers, which we will look at in a few slides coming up. Okay? So this is one critique with respect to measures that are based on shortest paths, because shortest paths are not the only holy grail of modeling information flows. The other critique is that, well, we said, good, we have something like vitality-based indices, for example, max flow betweenness, right? This is something we just introduced. Now, the flows seem to be much less local, right? Because there is obviously things flowing into the network, flowing here somewhere and flowing out again. And what's possible in here would basically take everything into account. So you might know from your physics lessons in school the communicating valves, right? If you pour water into such a system, the pressure would even out. And, well, basically the whole structure's geometry is taken into account, and not only the shortest paths. Now, the question is, does max flow betweenness solve that critique from one slide before? And we would see it actually doesn't. Let's take the following example, right? So we would take a special version of max flow betweenness where we would limit the edge capacity to 1. So 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. All the edges have a capacity of 1. And again, the max flow betweenness is the maximum possible flow through a node over all possible solutions to this ST maximum flow problem that we have introduced, right? And we'll have to average this over S&T. So the basic new assumption is that we limit our edge capacity to 1. And we see that this out edge here is limited to 1 as well as this in edge. And if you think that through, you would see that it's very unlikely, except for very extreme cases where we would have nodes that would be somewhere here and other nodes somewhere here, that would actually use this intermediate node C, right? So most of the flow would go through A and B. And introducing this shortcut wouldn't do much, as we will see later on when looking at the actual numbers. So again, this seems to not really respect the important position of C in that case. And the question is, what can we actually do? And Mark Newman suggests two very simple yet very innovative ideas. And the first one is to leave that ground of general flow and put it in a more specific context and discuss flow in terms of flow of electrical currents, because electrical currents seem to have one more twist to them which solves these problems in a way. And the other point of view, which we would see is equal to this electrical analogy, is random walk-based centrality. Well, so random walk-based centrality is easy explained. We'll discuss that in a second. So you wander around in the graph in a random fashion, and you count the number of times that you visit a node. Okay, obviously, a node is more central the more you visit this while stumbling around. Okay, it's the same if you go into a club, right? The bystanders are much less likely to be hit by the drunkards than the cool ones that are always in the center of things, right? So this is, it's the same thing, right? And we will see that both things solve these problems, right? And why am I introducing you to this? Because during the derivation, we will get to know a lot of modeling tricks, or small, very small modeling tricks, or ways to model things that would show us how these papers argue. And that's why I want you to learn that language, right? That's, we look at this as an example, okay? Good. Okay. So as already said, that random walk-based centrality idea, number of times that a walk starting at S and ending at T passes through some quantity, node or edge along the way. And, in a sense, the shortest path between the centrality is represents one extreme, and the random walk-based centrality represents another extreme, in the sense that a shortest path between the centrality way of thinking assumes that I know exactly where to go to. I know exactly which way the shortest paths run, whereas in the random walk-based case, I don't know nothing. Okay, so it's interesting that random walk-based centrality nevertheless has its pros in terms of the critique that was uttered two slides ago. Okay, good. So let's start with the electrical case first. So what we have is we have the flow of electrical current in a usual network, as you might know from school. So we have certain points, and there's resistors, and there's other things where other resistors are, and these points are then where you are able to measure the electrical potential or the voltage, right? And along the edges, you're able to measure the electrical current that flows, right? And you have that the voltage is something like the resistance times the current, yeah? So that's a very common formula from physics. And, well, these networks are really simple to compute. So it's becoming much more interesting if you have inductions or capacities in there or voltage sources or a combination thereof or operation amplifiers. And then this would become much more complicated. You would have to introduce complex quantities to account for phase and so on. Right? And then you'll end up with electrical engineering at this very subpart, like electronics, right? And this is very simple because we only have resistors and basically a simplified version of this basic equation. So at our source, we have one unit of current that enters the network, and at our sink, we have one unit of current that leaves the network, okay? And then we want to, the goal is to introduce a current flow between the centrality where the centrality of an edge, for example, or a node, is the amount of current that flows, in this case, through an edge or through a node, as we will see in this setup, averaged over all possible sources and sinks. Now, it is clear what is meant by that current flows along an edge, right? But it's less clear what is meant by a current flows here in such a node, because naturally what flows in must also flow out, yeah? But we can account for this later on, right? So we have current flows through those points as well, which we can define, okay? Good. So, you know that there is two basic laws from electrical engineering that govern these networks, and well, the first one, and these laws are called Kirchhoff laws, right? And there is a point rule which says that everything that flows into a node or a point must also flow out, and there is another thing which is in German called Maschenregel, which says that the sum over all voltages in a closed loop must also sum to zero. But this we would put aside for the moment. So Kirchhoff's point law is that the current in and outflow must average to zero. And this is just the respective matrix notation. So Aij is the adjacency matrix of the graph, which has an entry which is 1 if the two nodes I and J are connected, and 0 otherwise, right? And V is the voltage vector measured at all nodes. So if I have n nodes, the voltage vector V has n components, and we measure the voltage at each point, right? So This might confuse some of you, because things that are measured in volts, like the 220 volts that just come out of those sockets, are usually potential differences, right? So U is typically something where we would have V at a certain point minus V at some other point, yeah? So these Vs we could consider more as electrical potentials, but that's just for the physicists, right? So V is just the voltage at a certain point. And obviously, since we have something, one unit flowing in at S and one unit flowing out at T, we would account for this inflowing unit of current by a plus 1 and the outflowing unit of current by a minus 1. And that's the only way we could have something unequal to zero on the right side of the equation, if we are the sink, or if we are the sink T or the source S. Then we would have either plus 1 or minus 1. In all other cases, it's 0. So for all the other typical nodes. Okay, And that's just a way to state that Kirchhoff equation. Good. Now, if we sum over the rows of the adjacency matrix for a given node I, what we would get is just the degree of that vertex I. Right? So if we have the adjacency matrix and we have some node I, we would just count all the ones that are there, and if we sum them up, this would just give the degree ki of that node. Okay, just summing up the ones and we'll get this. So that's the first equation up there. And good. So if we use that knowledge and form a new matrix, which we call D, which has these degrees on the diagonal and zeros on each other position, so it's a diagonal matrix, we might write this equation from the previous slide, this Kirchhoff law, just in that way, right? So diagonal matrix minus adjacency matrix times the voltage vector would give this source vector, and the source vector is plus one only at S, minus one only at T, and has zeros otherwise. Okay, and why is this? Okay, let's look at the equation, obviously. So, summing over J, A, I, J gives K, I, and this is multiplied by V, I. This is just D times V, and A, I, J times V, J is just the, well, product matrix times vector A times V. So A times V, and there is a minus in between, and this is nothing else but the formalization of the source vector. Okay? And this quantity here, so degrees on the diagonal minus the adjacency matrix, also goes by the name of the graph Laplacian. That's something that you might find in graph theory as a basic notational quantity. Okay? Good. Okay, so that's that. Now, we might say, well, it's nice. We can find our voltages just by inverting this matrix D minus A. So if we put D minus A on the other side, as written in the lower right corner, bang, we have our voltage vector. But unfortunately, this doesn't work out because the graph Laplacian in that simple form is not invertible. So the determinant is zero. And why is that the case? Because the corresponding system of equation is overdetermined. Yeah? And this is somehow another way of stating that electrical potentials are always only defined up to a constant. Yeah? Because the only physical quantity is the voltage difference. These are the 220 volts that kill me if I put my finger in there, right? So if I say my potential is 10,000 and this one is 10,220, it's the same as stating as my potential is 400 and this one is 620. So it's always defined up to a constant. And there's a deeper physical reason for that, because the electrical field is just the derivative of the potential, and derivatives are, well, only defined up to an additive constant. Okay, that's clear. So that's the deeper reason why, in essence, these equations are not invertible, but it's very easy to make them invertible by just setting the voltage of one vertex to zero and to measure all the other vertices, voltages, in respect to that zero, or in respect to that node which you set to zero. So, in terms of the equations, this just corresponds to, I remove the vth row and the vth column of the graph Laplacian. I would set them all to zero. And now the graph Laplacian becomes invertible. Now, this construction where I replace or remove the vth row and column is denoted here by dv minus av. And now the voltages are in there. Now we can add back our vth row and column, okay, just with all zeros, and back to this inverted d minus a, and we will call this t. Now, obviously, the solution for an ST current flow problem with respect to node I is just TIS minus TIT. Bang. That's that. Okay, good. Now, we can use that to state what is the current flow that goes through a certain node. Okay, so we said that according to Kirchhoff, obviously what must flow in must flow out also. But it's a difference if there is 5 flowing in and 5 flowing out, so comparatively nothing happens, compared to 10,000 are flowing in and 10,000 are flowing out. Okay, so we would use that bookkeeping by stating that the current flow I at node I, if I use the source S and the sink T with 1 unit of current in, is just 1/2 of the absolute difference between the voltages of all possible nodes that this node I is connected to, right? So this is, so instead of saying that this sums to zero, I just take 1/2 times the absolute value. Okay? So in other words, this current flow at a node I is given by that expression if we just insert the solution that we just gained by our insight from the previous slides. Okay? And of course, at the source and the sink, the current flows are 1. We can then easily define our current flow between this by saying that I would just have to sum over all, again, as always, sum over all possible sink and source pairs in the graph. And obviously, there are 1/2 n times n minus 1 such combinations. Normalize them, and you have the current flow between this. Okay? Now, there is no proof whatsoever that this type of construction counteracts the critiques that I just mentioned at the beginning. So just take it for the moment as it is. We just somehow subtly changed the general flow problem to a more physical one, and that's the solution. Okay, bang. Saved, period, for the moment. Let's look at the random walk between the centrality as a way of comparing things, okay? Because we said, well, shortest path between us is somehow very extreme in terms of the knowledge. Why not do something very dumb and just behave as a random walker, okay? Good. So, the random walk between us of a node I would be the net number of times that a message or a walk passes through I on its journey, and again we have to average over all starting and arriving nodes S and T. Now with net number of times, we mean that we want to cancel back and forth passes, right? So if I have a construction like this, and I go like this, okay, I have passed 1, 2 times through it, but that is not what we want to count. So that is why we want to concentrate on the net number of times. Well, what we will now do is we will formalize this random walk notation because we will need that again with page rank. And then the message will be it's the same as electrical current between us, right? In a sense, this is surprising, and at the numbers at the end, we will see that it counteracts the critique. So, if I'm in node J, what is the probability that the next node of my random walk will be the node I? Good. So, obviously, I will need to be connected to node I via an edge. Otherwise, the probability is zero, right? That's why I have the adjacency matrix AIJ here obviously in the denominator. Now, if I'm a node with very many connections, then choosing one of them is inversely proportional to the number of connections, right? Now, that is why the probability Mij is Aij over Kj, where Kj is the degree of J, okay? In matrix notation, again, this is precisely that. So I have a matrix M, square matrix, I have the adjacency matrix, and again, I have this diagonal degree matrix D, and I would just have to take the inverse, which is simple because for a diagonal matrix, the inverse is just the diagonal matrix of the inverse of each of the elements on the diagonal, right? So that's, in this case, simple. Good. Good. So, the sink we will never leave, right? So, MIT is zero for all I. Cool. And we could safely, because of that, we could safely remove column T without affecting other transitions. That's nice. Okay. So, from our previous slide, we have M is A times D minus 1. So this matrix M, where we would remove the respective elements, we would call MT. And this is then AT times DT. Okay? Good. Now, if we start in S, what's the probability of arriving at J after S number of steps? Good. So M is the probability matrix where if I'm node I, what's the probability of reaching node I? If I'm node J, what's the probability of reaching I? That's M, right? And if I'm S, yeah, what's the probability of reaching J? Well, that is just MJS. And what's the probability of reaching J after R steps? That's M to the power R. Again, the jth element, right? Because obviously you iterate this probabilistic game. And that's something that we would call a Markov chain, okay? Because a Markov chain, if for those that know that, is just a graph where the edges are annotated with probabilities. You have a vector, a starting vector, stating the starting probabilities for each node, and then you do something which is very akin to the random walk. Yeah? So you let the Markov chain do the dynamics, which we will encounter in a few minutes, right? Good. So this is M to the power RJS, the matrix element. Now the probability that we then take a step to some adjacent vertex I is again this quantity here, which is the state that we're in a way, times 1 over the degree of J, as always, right? So if I'm J and I have a lot of connections, going to I is less probable than if I'm J and I'm having only a few connections where the connection to I is one of them. Okay, good. So this is from the previous slide. Now what we would then have to do is, obviously, we would have to take all durations into account. Yeah? So one step, two steps, 500 steps, 10 million steps. We would effectively have to sum over that quantity from zero to infinity. Okay. Now what's the outcome of this? If you sum over something from zero to infinity, right? Let's say I from zero to infinity, and you have some quantity qi. Well, this is just the geometric series, right? This is 1 over 1 minus q if q is smaller than 1, okay? It's if q is a normal number, right? Now, the same or something very similar is true for a matrix as well, right? So, if we have a matrix in there, we would have the same. So we would have the inverse of the identity matrix minus M and that inverted, right? This is like the same equation, just an analog of this. And what is the respective condition? Well, the respective condition is that all the eigenvalues must be smaller than 1 from and their absolute values, right? If this is the case, then the series will converge, and this is then the geometric series for the matrix version, right? Good. Now, back to this. So we have to sum from 0 to infinity. We'll get the geometric series because, and that is something you just have to believe, this condition here is met by this matrix M. Okay? Good. So the total number of times V, J, arrow I, we go from J to I, and we have this quantity averaged over all possible walks, is then this, which is just a scalar prefactor, and this is the result of the geometric series, right, by this operation. So in total, V would be D to the minus 1, this is this, times the result of the geometric series times the source vector, right? If we just put all the ingredients together, okay? Which is, by some simple analysis, the same as this, right? Good. Now, if we compare this to the electrical case, so in the electrical case, we had this equation, so the voltages, and here we had voltages, right, were D minus A inverse times the source vector. Now, in this case, we would have the same thing, or something very, something equivalent, if we start with a random walk, right? So this is a bit strange, right? But in essence, exactly the same things come out, okay? So, the net flow of the random walk along the edge from J to I is this voltage difference, and the voltage difference we had here as well, right? So now we're not having voltages, now we're counting the net number of times that we go through a certain node, okay? And again, the net flow through this vertex is half of the sum of the flows on the incident edges, just as here, right? That was this where I explained to you why we would, balance or account for the net number of times this random walk goes through, right? This is the same. Now, let's look at the respective numbers. Why do these things counteract our critique as before, right? So the shortest path between this, the major critique was, well, not everything flows along shortest paths. And the simple max flow between this was not everything flows bypassing shortcuts, right? And this electrical or random walk-based thing doesn't know anything about max flow optimization, right? Because the electrical current thing was somehow semi-local. We only computed this using the Kirchhoff laws, right? But not solving a general optimization problem, right? And that's the deeper reason why these random walk and electrical things, as local as they are, kind of counteract the critique. Now, this is network one. And you remember the critique, shortest path between this. This is group two, this is group one. Would always use this shortest route and never go the detour over C. And this is respected by the fact that the shortest path between this of vertex C is really low. It's just 0.2, while the vertex A and B have a shortest path between this of 0.64. Okay? Now, And in the second network, where we have this shortcut, we see that the max flow between us, and that's just this classical graph theoretical flow, not the electrical one, is even smaller. It has 0.004, whereas A and B have a centrality of 0.2. So it's several orders of magnitude smaller, right? If we now look at the random walk or current flow based between this centrality, we see that this is somehow mitigated, right? So while A and B still have a substantially higher centrality, which is okay, C has somehow improved with respect to A and B, right? And in this case, C has also improved by several orders of magnitude, right? And this is a case, so these types of centralities may, with some caution, be interpreted on a interval scale as well. That's the whole point of trying to come up with a construction like this, right? Because we're doing statistics, okay? So in this case, we see that somehow these things really counteracted the critique. And the take-home message is, well, through these derivations, we have learned how to use or how to efficiently represent the graph with matrices, how we efficiently make use of linear algebra in that sense, and that basically very different modeling ideas like this random walk type of thing and the electrical thing might lead to equivalent results which have properties that counteract some of the properties of given traditional measures. That's more or less the take-home message. Good. Now, for the end of today's lecture, we will be concerned with feedback centralities. And that, again, is a bit easier, right? Because the idea is rather easy. So, the basic idea of feedback centrality is the more central, a node is more central, the more central neighbors it has. Yeah? So, you're cooler, the more cool friends you have, right? And that's very simple. And there's a whole family of such indices, some more simple, some a bit more difficult. And one of them, an easy one, is the Hubble index, right? So if we have a weighted directed graph, we would then have a weighted adjacency matrix, so not only zeros and ones in that matrix, but the weights. So the centrality of a node V would then be proportional to the sum of centralities of the adjacent nodes. Okay, and not only to the sum of those centralities, but multiplied with the corresponding edge weight. So that would be something that says, I'm cooler the more cool friends I have, but even more so, I would be cooler the more cool friends I have and the more they like me. Yeah. Or the intenser the relation to them is. So if I have a lot of cool friends, but my relation is rather weak, they're not of much use in a way, and the light that they shed on me via their coolness would illuminate me only very vaguely because, well, the social relation is rather weak. Right? That's why we would have this equation. So S is weighted adjacency matrix times S. That's exactly a formalization of that. Well, you can already smell the eigen problem in there, right? But obviously, not every matrix has an eigenvalue of 1, which would correspond to this precise equation where the cursor now is, right? So in order to make this a generally solvable equation, we would have to introduce something, an inhomogeneous term here, right? And this, in this original conception of the Hubble index, is called a centrality input, right? So no one has to start with nothing, so you're given some degree of coolness by birth, right? For free. That's this what we start with, a centrality in input, or you might as well call this an external information. So coolness is not only determined within a given social network, but you're part of several social networks, and you might start with some coolness from the outside. And the typical example is if you go out in a club, right? Well, things count as they are. Yeah? So the more cool your friends you have in the club, the cooler you're in the club. But you would start with a degree of coolness depending, for example, on the money you have. So the brain surgeon has a much more cool starting point because he has a lot of money in his pockets and buy everyone a lot of drinks, right? Whereas someone that is very poor has a lower coolness by start, right? That's this external information, right? And if we have that, we can invert the matrix and solve for the respective centrality. Again, this matrix, identity matrix minus this weight matrix, is only invertible if, well, that's just the opposite formulation, if the geometric series converges, or the geometric series converges if I minus W is invertible, which means that the largest eigenvalue of W must be less than 1. If that's the case, all the eigenvalues are less than 1 with respect to the absolute value, and that means that this series converges. Right? That's the Hubble index. Very simple. And Brin and Page obviously had some knowledge of these things, right? So they would not start off with nothing. So Stanford is a good university that seems to have told them something about graph theory. And then they came up with their own idea, which is PageRank. And it's basically the same. Yeah. Now, well, in order to understand that, we would just have to go back to our random walker, right? So random walker is now a random surfer on web pages. So if we want to be Brin and Page, we would consider when is actually a web page, a good web page, that we should rank higher in our information retrieval ranking. Well, the answer is it's a good web page if it links to other good web pages. Okay, and well, the link graph is what they analyzed in their original version to came up with PageRank. Okay, so again, we have a directed, let's say an unweighted graph, because links on the web don't carry weights. Okay, so if we would again have a Markov chain as before, the transition matrix would be that. So Tij from node J to I, in this case, typically these things are read in the opposite way, but since we have an undirected graph, it doesn't matter too much. It's 1 over degree, out degree of I, if we have an edge, right? So this is not in this reverse reading style, but in the forward reading style, so T from I to J. It's 0 if we don't have an edge, and if the page doesn't link to anything, in order to not get stuck, we would say that in this case, we would have a random jump somewhere in the web. So this is 1 over the number of websites that are out there, right? So if I arrive at a page as a random surfer, if I arrive at a page which doesn't have any links to the outside, well, why ever, then I would have 1 over V, right? So it's a directed graph, since links go from one page to another page, obviously, right? That's just the formalization. That's just the same thing in words as this, right? So, so we might as well add a small probability here instead of the 0 in order to avoid getting stuck in, well, sync circles. Well, that would be a dynamic getting stuck. And so I'm going back and forth between those things. So I might as well have a random jump probability even in those cases where I have outlinks, right? So that would kind of solve this problem of getting stuck in those sync circles. Now, as before, what we would need to do is to solve the corresponding eigenvalue problem or to ask in the language of Markov chains, is there a unique stationary distribution of this Markov chain? And that would then correspond to the page rank. Okay? And this stationary distribution is usually denoted as pi. You might know this from probability theory. And, well, a unique stationary distribution exists if the chain is irreducible and positively recurrent. So irreducibly roughly means that you can reach any node from any other node. And positively recurrent means that you have a finite chance of coming back to each node. So that's a way to formalize that the whole system is somehow well-behaved and not pathological, right? If this is the case, then we have unique stationary distribution. And in order to really make sure that this is irreducible, we would add, again, some, external information as before, with a parameter alpha that just controls this, the weight, the relative weight of this external information. Okay, so that is like this external information is considered to be fully stochastic. So no brain surgeon in the club effect here, right? Good. Now, obviously, computing the stationary distribution is somehow linked to degree centrality. And why is that? So, if we have an undirected, unweighted graph with adjacency matrix A, I state that if the matrix is just the transition matrix is given by that, and we have seen why this is the case, Aij, to ensure that we actually can have a transition, 1 over the degree of I in order to quantify the probability. Jumping over to J, right? Then my statement is that the stationary distribution pi I is just degree of I over this sum term. And the proof is really easy, right? Because in Markov chains, what you would usually want as a notation is to have the transition matrix, and you would not multiply the vector of current state probabilities from the right, as usual, if you want to multiply something with a matrix. So you would have something like A times X is equal to B. So this is multiplication from the right. And in Markov chains, what you usually do, and this is very easy to understand if you regard the respective math, you multiply from the left. Okay. So what must come out if you have some stationary distribution times the Markov matrix, which encodes the dynamics of random surfing, you must end up with exactly the same again. That's this page rank style distribution. Now, just by inserting the quantities, I would get the following things. So Tij is that. So and pi I, this is the ith component of the stationary distribution, I said would be this. So if I introduce pi I would get this. So Tij is still in there. And if I additionally introduce Tij, then the numerators would just cancel. This would just cancel against this. And I arrive at this expression. Now, we know that if we sum over the rows or columns of the adjacency matrix, keeping the respective row or column number of the other end fixed, we would just get the degrees. Yeah, that's what I had here on the blackboard. Right? This is just that. And since we have that, well, this expression in the numerator would just give the degree of node J, and this is just what we had. Right? So it's a bit of a children's proof, and you formally would need a bit more than that, but it shows that it's comparatively easy with these assumptions to come up with stationary distributions. Now, Brin Page, well, translated this into this equation, which is just a variant, right? So what they introduced is this scalar quantity D, which they called a damping factor, but the rest of all the things are comparatively, yeah, they're the same as the stuff before, right? So C is C again times the matrix of transitions formalizing the dynamics of the random surfer, right? And 1 minus D is just to make the matrix stochastic again. In matrix notation, this is exactly that, right? So centrality is damping factor times matrix, and this is the eigenproblem plus this added quantity here, right? Again, this is the transition matrix as we had. Now, having this equation, how do we solve that? Okay, how did Brin and Page solve that? Obviously, so if you have a trillion web pages or a gazillion web pages as are out there, so you'll already fail at inverting a million times a million matrix with usual simple linear algebra methods. Obviously, it's a hard thing to do. Now, although we might write down the solution in that form, this is not how you would numerically do it. So numerically, what you would do is you would compute a matrix inverse via power iteration, right? So you start with a random C, exert it to the system's dynamics by multiplying it repeatedly with the matrix P until you reach the final a stationary distribution. So that's basically executing the Markov chain a number of times, a finite number of times. And if things stay comparatively stable, if nothing changes anymore, then you have reached a approximation of the stationary distribution. So in essence, you have to repeatedly multiply your current C by the matrix P, insert it into that equation, and you get your new version of C. So the versions or the power iterations are denoted by this upper index, right? So it's not actually a power. So this is not the power C to the power C plus K plus 1, but it's just the K plus first iteration, K plus 1st iteration. Well, this is simple so-called Jacobi power iteration. The observation is that if you compute this for a large number of web pages, for example, you may be at some point in the computation, let's say we have 1 billion web pages, which is not the case because these days we have, I don't know, like a trillion or 100 billion, I don't know. Let's assume you have 1 billion, 10 to the 9. And say after 500 million, you're somehow in the computation. Yeah. So there is no reason if you want to compute the 500 million and first new C K plus 1, why wouldn't you use your 500 million previous computations from the current iteration, right? So the simple Jacobi one would just use everything from the previous iteration, yeah? But in your current iteration, you have done a lot of work. You have already computed 500 million numbers, which are a better estimate, yeah, than the first 500 million of the previous iteration. So why don't you use them? And this is then called Gauss-Seidel iteration. So up to a certain point, you would use the newly computed versions, and those that you just don't know, you take from the previous iteration, which is a bit fast, leads to a bit faster convergence. So, and if you ask me how do they do it at Google, I have no idea. Right? So they might do something completely different these days. So it's rumored that even so the core search business of Google is something that's really strictly located at Mountain View, I presume behind very strong metal doors. And what they do, I don't know. And somehow they would use this, they would use other heuristics, they would use a lot of magic to do their stuff. I think most of the stuff is, as you know, more in the fields of how they do the numerics, how they organize their servers, how they organize it in layers, how they do this MapReduce type of job scheduling and so on. This is more this performance side of things. So in the actual search business, I think it boils down to natural language processing heuristics. So all the magic that occurs when you type in pizza and you get the pizza from Munich and not from all over the place, stuff like that. But the basic things would have to be comparatively simple. So what Google presumably won't do or cannot do is compute more elaborate machine learning-based semantical models such as topic models or stuff like this. Because they're a bit, well, they're, that doesn't scale, right? So if I have a million documents, I can compute a topic model for it. But if I have a gazillion documents, I just can't, right? Because it's too complex. So I assume that most of the stuff is still their good old-fashioned thing loaded with some intelligent heuristics, but I don't know. I've never worked for them. I think that Professor Schütze at LMU, which is a natural language processing super expert, he told me the other day that he worked for Google for 2 years or so. So if someone's interested in the magic behind those things, I would advise them, her, to go to Schütze for guided research or something. Right? Good. So, well, that's that. Well, we have 2 more minutes, but that I won't take. So, however, I think that tomorrow, and that's important, tomorrow we didn't schedule a lecture, right? So, however that may be, we will have to do it because of temporary restrictions. So I talked to you about the exercise. And the exercise is something that applies to all of you, but not only the non-game students, which are only very few. Who's games engineering? Ah, very nice. So more than I thought. Apologies. Now, the exercise is for everybody, and on next Wednesday, Christoph and I will introduce that to you. And in the exercise, we'll be doing a lot of social network analysis stuff. As I told you, we will take your real social network here in the class. We will ask you for things as how intense is the relation from you to him. And you would probably say, I don't know. I don't know him. Or you would say, it's my best friend. I don't know. Right? We will have to see. And we will analyze that. And in order to be able to do it, we would need the whole set of tools. That's why I will tomorrow continue with the lecture, and tomorrow we'll be looking at dense subgraphs, so group models, cliques and plexes and stuff like that. The other things then remaining is social network analysis is graph clustering, and then we'll proceed along these lines to have enough tools for this exercise. Yeah, that's the reason why tomorrow we'll be having a lecture at 8:15. Yeah, tomorrow. It's continuing. Yeah. Even next week, it's going to be 2 days. Yeah, and I will take care that in total, we'll not be having more than the 3 hours of lecture, right? So I will not force that upon you every Wednesday, like eat more of that graph theoretic stuff. I will take care that in general we'll be having it all. But I think it's quite nice to have it rather at the beginning of the term to have more time to prepare for the really important stuff. Okay, so I will take care of this. So tomorrow we'll be having a lecture. Next week we'll also be having 2. Yeah, so that just set for the others. So we'll be presumably be meeting tomorrow at 8:15. See you.